In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the second series of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston. And Liz, we've had quite an exciting time since our last recording. Well, shall we say, you have had quite an exciting time.
No, we both have. You know, it's been a long while and we do apologise that the episodes are like hen's teeth. They're pretty scant at the moment. But it's just because life's so busy, Helen. You're work, girl.
Well, that's it. And I love it. I love just being away and meeting all the different people and doing a variety of things. I've done some driver guiding, Liz, which is, you know, I'm always quite nervous when I start it off, when I hire the car and think, oh, my goodness. And then when I get going, I just love it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's certainly lovely to have a captive audience in there with you, although I hate the driver guiding. Definitely don't like that.
But you have been in foreign pastures.
I have, Helen. I mean, I've just been very, very lazy at the beginning of the guiding year. All my guiding is backloaded from today onwards, basically. I'm guide. It's a different story, but I have had such wonderful adventures. Most recently, I was across in Spain meeting up with two of our friends that those of you who listen to the podcast Spanish Loops are familiar with. Jorge, I met with him in Madrid. And then I went again to Pamplona for the Festival of San Fermín and the Running of the Bulls. Now, I know that the Running of the Bulls isn't to everybody's taste and it's not mine, but it is such a spectacle. It's one of the great spectacles that it is just so exciting. And the atmosphere, it's just, and the chance to meet up with friends, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, and I mean, some of the photographs that you put up, you sent through, Liz, and some of the video, the wee filmings, they're absolutely fantastic. I don't know if I'd like to be there and see it, but it just looks as if the whole town is taken up with it, isn't it?
It just takes over completely. Every age group, you know, that's what's lovely about it. It's whole families, grandparents and whatever. I have never been to a bullfight and I never will go to the bullfight. But this is actually the bulls' opportunity to get their own bag. I mean, what they're doing is they're driving them from the pen where they hold them overnight through the streets to the bull ring. So it's a test of your manhood. And then nowadays, there's a lot of women run it as well. You know, absolutely crazy. But it's a tradition. It's the culture. It's not for me to criticise it. And the atmosphere is electric.
Yeah, it just sounds fantastic. Well, I wasn't doing anything quite as exciting as that, but I had some quite interesting little stopovers, because when you're driver guiding, Liz, you've got to find your own accommodation and you have a limited budget, shall we say. So what is available within the limited budget is quite interesting. So one of the places I stayed was a really stunning little, I call it a shepherd's hut. It was just a lovely little sort of cabin, one room cabin, which had everything in it that you needed. And I just loved it. It was great. My big thing was it had plenty of space in front of it to park the 9-seater that I was driving. And I was on Google Earth checking that I could, with lots and lots of little cuts, I could turn the 9-seater round in the space available. So yeah. I did that.
That must be the nightmare of a driver guide that you get somewhere where you can't get out of.
Oh, no. Yes. And I always think I need a big, big space.
And these shepherd huts are becoming really popular. You can buy them now. I'd love to stay in one. So definitely on the bucket list.
Yep. It was beautiful.
And of course, video didn't kill off these two radio stars, because we were stars of BBC Radio 2, OJ Bor, unfortunately, in the middle of the night.
Oh, half past 12 at night. It was amazing. And I was on tour, so I was in my hotel room in Dunkeld House Hotel. And I think, where were you, Liz?
I was at home here. Yep. So it was a case of, it's a midnight mastermind where he gets an expert, if you could call us that, ask him three questions, and he has one record to research it. And so we were asked, we got an email out of the blue asking if we would do Scottish landmarks.
Yes, and it was great because it was quite nice. It was over before you could blink an eye, but it was quite fun, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, we managed to stump him with one. He got two correct, and we stumped him with one. So we'll put the link up for that. It's already up there, I think, on social media. But if anybody wants to listen in, as you say, blink and you'll miss it. But it's up there for posterity.
That's right.
Another string to our bow.
Oh, yes. So we've got an episode to do, Liz, so we better introduce what we're doing.
Yeah, well, last episode we were talking about the many churches that dot our landscape, so important landmarks in Scotland. But of course, when you think of Scotland, what's it most famous for in terms of its landscape? Probably its hills and glens.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful hills and glens. I must just put in one wee story here, Liz. Andrew Carnegie, whom many people will know of, Andrew Carnegie was very upset. He came home from school one day as a little boy, and his uncle said to him, "Oh, Andrew, why are you crying? What's wrong?" "Oh, the teacher told me that England was bigger than Scotland." And Uncle Lodger said, "Oh, no, don't you worry, Andra. If you flattened out all the hills in Scotland, Scotland would be much bigger than England."
Very true. Scots' competitive nature. Yeah, but a question for you, Helen. When does a hill become a mountain?
I know, I'm not sure, Liz, because I always just talk about the hills. I very often, very, very seldom use the word mountain when I'm talking about the hills of Scotland.
You have even the tallest hill, the tallest mountains on Skye, the Coolans, because very often we don't call them anything. We just call them the Ochils or the Coolans or the Grampians, the Cairngorms. Even the Coolans are referred to as the Coolan Hills. And actually, there is no worldwide consensus on what the definition of a mountain is. But in Great Britain and Ireland, it's often taken to be any summit over 2,000 feet. But of course, in Scotland, we have so many of those that there was a real problem. How did we define a mountain? And that was done by a man called Sir Hugh Munro, right back when he published a table of mountains in 1891.
And the interesting thing was that when they set out to sort of look and see what are the heights and catalogue these mountains, they thought they were only going to be looking at about 30. And he came up with a huge number, didn't he, of mountains?
He did indeed. And if you think about it, nowadays we have the advantages of things like GPS and satellite and great technology for measuring heights. But he only had his own skill to use Ordnance Survey maps and his mountaineering skills to go out and to catalogue them. And he came up in his original list with 283. So Hugh Munro had been one of the original founding members of the Scottish Mountaineering Club back in 1891. And one of the reasons that it was founded was to actually list and catalogue the mountains in Scotland that were over 3,000 feet high. And he was the ideal person for this, because not only was he such an expert mountaineer and hill walker, but he also was extremely meticulous in keeping records and his experience of the great outdoors and everything. So the task was given by this newly fledged Scottish Mountaineering Club to one of their own, Sir Hugh Munro. Very interesting man.
Yes, because he is one of the Munros of Fowlis that were given their baronetcy by King James VI, a baronetcy of Nova Scotia, when James VI was always trying to raise money. So he was trying to raise money and gave out these baronetcies for money. And the Munros of Fowlis became one of those baronetcies. But Sir Hugh was kind of the last one, wasn't he, Liz?
He was, because when it was given out, it was to be given to the male heir. Now, interestingly, Sir Hugh Munro was also the last chief of Clan Munro. because he didn't have a male heir, he had a daughter. So while the chieftaincy passed to his daughter, the baronetcy went out of circulation because there was no male heir to pass it on to. But another interesting thing was that the family lands were beside Kirriemuir, the wee red toonie that we've talked about in a previous episode. And if you go there, you can go to the museum and see all about him there.
Yes, and you know, sadly, he never actually got to... He did a lot of his work was desk work, cataloguing the Munros and just going out into some of them and, you know, checking some. But he never actually got to climb the full list of Munros, did he? He died of pneumonia before that happened.
Yeah, three summits. He just about got them all. He thought there was 283 and he missed three summits, one on Skye, two in the Cairngorms. But he came from a great line of soldiers. You know, the Fowles, his family were all in the military service. And World War I broke out. He was too old because he was 58. And so he was too old for service. So he took up volunteer work with the Red Cross. And he went off, first of all, to Malta. But he had to come back there because he got ill. And then when he recovered, he rejoined the Red Cross again. And this time he went off to the front line in France. He was in Provence. And at the end of the war, I think it was Spanish flu, was it, at the end of the war? It was certainly a pandemic. Yeah. And he died in 1919 on the 19th of March, aged 63. And of course, 2019, there were great celebrations for the anniversary of his death. But such a shame because on his grave, which is at the family estate at Lindertis near Kirriemuir, there's a plaque that says, "Mountaineer, author of the Tables of Scottish Hills, inspiring generations of mountaineers." And he certainly did that because these mountains over 3,000 feet were forevermore called the Munros.
That's right. And people just know it's a sport to do your Munro bagging, climb as many as you can and tick them off as you do.
And it's really sad that one of the three that he failed to climb was actually the one that was closest to his home in the Cairngorms. Now, I can't pronounce it.
No.
And this is my big problem with Munros, because most of them are in Gaelic. So this one, I think, is Cam Cloch Vullen. And he didn't climb it because he was saving the best to last, just to go out his back door and climb the local hill, and he never made it.
I think that's what I would do as well if I was doing it. I would keep the one closest to home to the last, although there is a suggestion sometimes when we're on Mull that the Munro on the island of Mull is the last one. Ben Moore is the last one that people like to do, so they have to take a ferry to it.
Yeah, it's said to be the last island Munro because, of course, there's a bridge across to Skye now, so Skye might have lots of Munros, but Mull is the only one that you have to take a ferry to.
Yeah, I think the way the ferries are at the moment, Liz, I think I would get Ben Moore done when the ferries were running and just go there, do it, and then not say I'm going to save that till the last, just in case.
I think so. Well, he might not have been able to complete all of his 283, but certainly plenty have done it. The first one to do it was allegedly a man called the Reverend A.E. Robertson, who completed the first, what you call the round of Munros, when you complete them all. He did that in 1901. And famously, when it was reported at the time, when he got to the top of his last Munro, he famously kissed the cairn first and then his wife.
Yeah, but it also assumes then that his wife was with him. So she, you know, nobody ever mentions that she might have climbed Munros as well, but she obviously did.
Maybe got to the top before him, or maybe she just
kept the
easy one for last. Yeah. But it's a really popular pursuit now. And of course, nowadays we refer to it as Munro bagging after Sir Hugh Munro.
Yes, and my stepson, he's done all the Munros. And Helen, his wife, is in the process of completing her Munros. They're up in the Gearlock area at the moment, I think, getting some Munros under their belt. And my grandson, Ian, he's, you know, working away at the Munros himself too. So it's definitely a thing that people want to do.
Yep, and if they do them nowadays, you don't have to do 283, because when Munro himself died, the Scottish Mountaineering Club took over the job of keeping the list up to date. And of course, with new measuring techniques, it's changing the list all the time. There's officially 282 Munros now, but they also have what are called Munro tops, because a top is a mountain that comes out of a mountain. So it's not just all about the height, it's about, you know, the topographical prominence, as you would say, standing out as a landmark from the area around about it. So 282, and all of them are in the Scottish Highlands.
I think that's fantastic. Well done to Uncle George Lauder for telling Andra that.
Exactly. But the Scottish Mountaineering Club try to keep the old traditions alive. And one of the things that they do is they say that anyone who completes all of the summits is known as a completer. And that's spelt C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T-E-R, a completer. And if you complete, as your friends have all done, your friends and relations, then you're eligible to join the Monroe Society, which was founded in 2002.
Yeah, and I think that must be quite a thing. But we've had some amazing completers and some very, very young completers, Liz.
Absolutely.
We've had the youngest one was age 10, was it, when she completed everything, all the Monroes?
Yeah, that was just relatively recently, just in October 2022, a little girl called Quinn Young. She came from Inverness, and she did them all with her dad, on her own, carrying her own backpack and all her supplies and everything, her waterproofs, you know. She did it all. The first one she did, I think, was Ben Nevis when she was just five.
I find that really hard. She must be a strong wee thing just to keep going up Ben Nevis, because although there's a pathway, it's hard going. And Ben Nevis, of course, as people know, is the highest mountain in the UK.
It is. And if you think about conditions out on these Monroes, particularly in winter, they're atrocious.
Oh, they're very bad. And they're very changeable. You could start off in almost shorts and T-shirt weather. And then by the time you have done about an hour, you're into Arctic conditions. And then you could be back to shorts and T-shirt, and then back to Arctic or rain. Just, you cannot predict what the weather is going to do on any of these hills.
And when we have visitors from across the world come to Scotland, you know, and they look at our mountain ranges, the Grampians, the Cairngorms, the Mona Leiths, and they think, oh, we've got higher mountains than those at home. And what they have to realise is that these ridges have been worn down by millions of years of erosion. But also, it's about the latitude and the winds and weather systems that are exposed to coming in from the Atlantic and the Arctic. So as you see, even in summer, the conditions can just change in a matter of minutes and change to thick fog, strong wind, you know, the driving rain that's right in your face. And once you get to the summit of them, it can be freezing even in summer.
Yes, it just takes me back to when I used to go skiing up in Cairngorm. Now, that we didn't go to the top of Cairngorm, but close by. You're skiing down on the ice, because we never had soft powder snow, skiing down on the ice, and I wore contact lenses at that time, and you could just hear that it wasn't rain, it was hail going ding, 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 ding against the contact lenses. You think, oh, well. And they wore a hair quite long and in bunches, and you know, the bunches were probably about, you know, 3 inches long when you're at the top of the slope, but by the bottom of the slope, they're probably about 9 or 10 inches long with the icicles hanging from them.
Well, most of my walking of higher ground, because I'm a softie these days, but what was done when I was a child with my family, and I have recollections of being on Cairngorm. I don't think we were quite at the summit, but we were nearly there when the weather changed, the clouds came down, white out, and my dad, stay where you are, just stay where you are until this blows over. Yes. And we're sitting there thinking, I'm not staying where I am, I'm wanting down, until eventually he gave the sign that we could proceed down, and we always carried with us black bin liners, bags. Plastic bags. And so our great trick was you could sit on these and sledge down. So my memory is sledging down on these black bin liners between all the skiers on Cairngorm. So not particularly well prepared for the
course, talking about the weather, the mountain bothies are absolutely key on the hills, and this is a mountain bothy association which look after these. They're just very basic little huts that are dotted around the mountains where they can be used as shelter. They've got virtually nothing in them. You've placed for a fire and that's about it. You can stay the night in them, but you'll basically have your own sleeping bags, and you're sleeping on the floor. But I was surprised, Liz, when I was looking at that before we broadcast, that you've actually are now advised to book You're really? Mountain bossy. Yes, although what? I'm sure you wouldn't be turned away if the weather was awful. But I think people are booking it, but it says advised to book just so that you get a space. I thought, goodness me, that just shows you how things have changed.
I mean, there's a lot of them up in the Cairngorms, and some of them are readily accessible now, like Rivoan, which is really popular. So I could see how you would have to book that one. But it's really just because people can walk up past the Green Lock and get to it very easily.
Yes.
But when you get out into the ones that they're just unlocked and they're left available, they've got bunk beds, but also you've got the Bothy code. So you've got to clean it, brush it, and everything before you leave. And in fact, there's actually one which we go to on the May holiday every year. We still do it from right back from when I was a child. We always went up and we had a picnic at this one. And my dad's ashes are scattered on a tree up above it because we love to play hide and seek. So behind a tree
lovely.
That we used to hide behind, that's where my dad's ashes are scattered up in the Cairngorms.
That's lovely. That's lovely and quite appropriate for this little podcast.
Absolutely.
But so the mountain bossies are very important for all generations.
Yep. But, you know, over time, since this Munro bagging became a big thing, particularly back in the 1980s, the record for doing them in different conditions has just been broken and broken and broken. And that's one of the reasons why we chose this as our topic, because on the 26th of June this year, an ultra runner, you know, looking for bigger and bigger and bigger challenges, called Jamie Arons or Arons, well, she broke not only the record for females, but the record for both male and females as the fastest ever round. And she broke the previous record, which was held by a Marine called Donnie Campbell from Skye, so he was no slacker, and she broke it by over 12 hours.
I mean, I just cannot understand how they can do this, because they do it as what's called self-propelled. They don't use any means of transport. They either run, kayak, bicycle, whatever. You know, their own body is transporting them, and they do all these Munros. Ridiculous. All I can see is ridiculous, Liz.
It is. She did it in 31 days, 10 hours and 27 minutes. Now, the average person takes 8 years to bag all them, and was 31 days, 10 hours and 27 minutes. And she was able to do this because she doesn't sleep. She's able to take 90-second power naps. So our support team, you know, couldn't believe it, that she just needs 90 seconds, she'll fall asleep, boom, right, 90 seconds, wake me up, and that's how ready to go again.
Oh, that doesn't seem healthy, does it? But she did something like 932 miles on foot and about the same distance by bicycle. So and she started off on Ben Moore on Mull, so she would have to take a ferry across, unless she swam or kayaked. She maybe kayaked over.
Yeah, she
from
did.
Mull.
Yep. Yeah. 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 And I mean, it's when you look at all the statistics, you know, of what you've got to climb, she had to ascend 459,000 feet. That's the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest 16 times.
And the only difference is she wouldn't have the altitude to contend with.
Well, that's true.
But still, it's 16 times on Everest. My goodness.
And when you see people doing these Munros like her, it never ceases to amaze me that they always have their dogs with them. So the poor dogs don't have any choice. You know, how many dogs have bagged all the Munros?
Well, she, of course, has climbed the Munros on two occasions before this. Once with her partner, so she took him along with her, and then with the dogs. So it's just crazy, Liz.
I don't know if they get their certificate as being a completer, but they certainly they get there. I can't remember. What's the saying about on a butcher's dog? There's no, you know, it's well fed. I can't remember.
Right.
They're not carrying any fat. There's a saying, something about it, that obviously they'll be lean and fit having done all of this. But I think probably the biggest challenge, and again, this has been one that's been the record broken time and time again, is to do the Munros in winter, where they're really, really challenging. And in over the pandemic period, right at the beginning, just as the pandemic broke out, a man called Kevin Woods from Glasgow, who's a freelance journalist and, you know, writer on outdoor pursuits, he climbed all 282 Munros in 97 days over that winter. So he was as well being isolated out on the Munros as he was isolating down in lockdown down here.
That's right, because in fact he said that, didn't he? He said that young people said, what was it like being out on the hills? He said, well, I was isolated and I would have been isolated at home as well. So he said it was no different, except that he was on a mountain with lots of snow and ice. Well, there was a wee difference.
Yeah, and he says that his van, he would wake up and it was being rocked by the wind, like you, Helen, pounded by hail showers,
yes.
Hail showers, lightning going off all around. You know, just the having the fortitude to be able to actually see the job through and finish it as quickly as you can. So total admiration for these people. It won't be me. As we've said before, the only thing that I'll be bagging is my messages at Tesco's.
That's right, yes. In fact, he walked 1,400 miles, Liz. You know, Edinburgh to Rome is equivalent.
Oh, my goodness.
And you just think, oh, no. As you say, walk to the shops, that's fine enough.
More to life than that. Yes. Anyway, have you bagged any Munros, Helen? What are the Munros that you've bagged? What are your favourites?
Well, I have, but I have to say not in very recent years. Mm-hmm. Most of my Munro bagging was done, I think I would almost say before children.
Yeah.
You know, because that's when you were out and about in the hills and doing things. So I have been to the top of Ben Nevis, and that was quite a hike, but always went fully equipped with the proper equipment and the rucksack with all the things that you didn't need that at that moment in time, but you may need as you went. And I remember we came down and we were really sort of weary, having been to the top, and we were walking down. We were near the foot, just crossing over. There's a wee bridge over a burn, and we met these three Japanese gentlemen in their business suits and, you know, business shoes, and they sort of said, is this the way to the top? And we said, yes, but you're not going there. Because you just looked at their outfits, they wouldn't have got 50 yards without being soaked to the skin. So that was Ben Nevis. And of course, when you get to the top, it's quite different to what you expect. You expect to be standing on a peak, but you're actually standing, it's quite a plateau. And there's a wee weather station up there as well. And of course, it depends when you go, lots of bits and pieces that people have carried for a challenge up to the top of Ben Nevis. They forget to carry them down, though, which is not so good.
Yeah, I haven't done Ben Nevis, but there's a lot of spoof reports in the site that they TripAdvisor. There's lots of spoof reports on TripAdvisor saying this was a great disappointment. No restaurant at the top, no toilet facilities, and all of that. I think most of them are written tongue in cheek, but yeah. I've never actually done it. But because Ben Nevis is so accessible, that's why people, you know, get out on the paths and think that the lower paths are what they're going to have all the way up to the top. So lots of fatalities. But in fact, most of the fatalities are not inexperienced people who sort of stumble into it, but the ones that tackle it in winter. And so lots of accidents with people doing the ice climbing. So when you visit when you pass the hospital in Fort William, it has a special trauma centre for all those that get injured out on the hills. And, you know, if they get hypothermia or something like that, it's got these special facilities to be able to deal with it, which is a sign that it's no easy job.
No, yep. And it's interesting when you say about, you know, a lot of the experienced climbers have come to grief, mainly, as you said earlier, about your dad saying, stop, don't move, when the whiteout comes, that just a footstep away could be quite a precipice.
Absolutely.
You know, several hundred feet going down. So just stop, don't move until you know exactly where you are.
Yep. So haven't done Ben Nevis, but one of the easiest and the one that's probably the most popular and the most accessible is just a short trip from Glasgow, and that's Ben Lomond in the Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park. So I have done that. I haven't walked it. I've actually done it on the back of a horse, because I used to do a lot of pony trekking when I was young. And so we went on a trek, and my abiding recollection of that is that one of the ponies actually fell into one of the drainage ditches.
Oh, dear.
And it was on its back, and we had a real struggle to get this horse out of this drainage ditch. So not a particularly pleasant memory that I have of Ben Lomond, but I did actually do that one.
Well, actually, I've done Ben Lomond as well, Liz, and I did it when I was still at school, at high school, and it was a high school trip that we did, and we, you know, a whole group of us, and I think it was sixth year, went up Ben Lomond, and these were the days where you could quite safely hide in the bracken. That's the Fernlight plant. Nowadays, despite what Outlander says, I would no way would I go near bracken because of all the ticks. Uh-huh. But those days you could hide in the bracken. So we had great fun. Typical school kids, you know, hiding in the bracken and jumping out at our friends, you know.
Using them as spears. We used to do that.
So yes.
Go at the furthest, yeah. But you won't be surprised to hear that where I have done most of them is the Cairngorms. I'm not saying I've done most of the Munros in the Cairngorms, but most of my Munros, because the Cairngorms National Park has more than 50 Munros. So although Ben Nevis might be the highest, the next ones are largely all located in the Cairngorm National Park.
Yes, and that's really beautiful. And of course, they now say that Cairngorm itself is, you know, is it a Munro or is it not? Because you can drive up to the ski car park. You can then get a vernacular railway up to within, you know, a hop and a skip to the summit. You can you say that you've bagged that Munro, or should you start at the bottom and walk all the way up?
Yeah, well, I think if you are a completer, you would have to say that you'd walked up. But now, of course, because so many people are going up to the summit, if you got off the funicular, you have to have a guide to take you.
Yes.
Because, you know, people straying far from the path again, all the risks of it. But my favourite Munro in the Cairngorm National Park is Ben McDooey. I've done it, and I've done it with its head in the clouds, which is what Nevis means, actually, mountain with its head in the clouds. But the big legend that's associated with Ben McDooey is the big grey man of Ben McDooey, which is a kind of Scottish Bigfoot. And they think it's some kind of weather effect, which is a Brocken spectre, where this grey cloud comes down and gives this impression that you've got this great big Scottish grey Bigfoot, the big grey man of McDooey.
Yes, but even, you know, the Professor John Norman Colley, he was talking about that in a speech he made in New Zealand, and say he's never felt the fear that he felt when he heard this crunch, crunch, crunch of footsteps behind him when he was up in the Cairngorm on Ben McDooey. And then he just, everywhere he went, there was still this crunch, crunch. And then he turned around and saw this and he ran. He said he ran for 5 miles down to get to Rothie Murchis Estate. Now, this was a well-known, respected mountaineer. He said he was terrified.
Oh, well, I hope I don't meet him when I'm out on my travels through the Cairngorm National Park. I think probably the one that we're most familiar with, the Munros, these days on our tours is, of course, Glencoe. Because there's 8 Munros round about there, and probably the most famous of them all, the Three Sisters.
Yes, and of those, Buccalette of Moher and Buccalette of Beg are up there too. I don't know if Buccalette of Beg is actually a Munro, but Buccalette of Moher is. And it's something like more than 30,000 people try to climb it every year.
Mm. And you see it on all the postcards and the calendars. Yes. It's the most photographed.
It's beautiful. That little white house just at the foot of it to give you perspective in the photographs.
Yeah, no, it's certainly beautiful. The Valley of Sorrow, you know, when it's raining and all the water streaming off it. And of course, you've got the story of the massacre of Glencoe. So it's certainly a very, very powerful place to visit.
That's right. And on the opposite side to the Three Sisters, you've got Enochiach, the ridge. And I understand, I think it might just be story, but it's quite close to story that one part of that ridge is one-way traffic because it's so thin on the top. It's not enough space for 2 climbers to pass, steep drops on either side. So there is an unwritten rule that you cross that bit in one direction only.
Oh my goodness. And of course, when you're talking about ridges, probably the most famous of that and some of the most inaccessible of these Munros will be on Skye in the Coolans of Skye. Yeah. And you'll not catch me up there.
No, I've done a little bit. Again, this is all going back before children, but I've done a little bit up there, but not the heavy stuff, not the real stuff, the stuff that people go to the Coolans to do. My grandson was on Skye about a month ago, and he did a couple of Munros on Skye with his friends.
And of course, many of our Munros are looked after. They're in protected area, which is under the protection of the National Trust for Scotland. I think it's 46, 48, something like that, of them that actually are. And of course, the most famous, probably the Five Sisters of Kintail.
Yes, the Five Sisters of Kintail are absolutely beautiful. And that's what they're supposed to be, because the story is that there were 6 sisters of Kintail, you know, girls, 6 girls. And one day, this gentleman came calling, but he was not terribly attractive in many ways. He had a sort of few disabilities about him, but he took away one of the sisters, the youngest sister, promising that he'd another five brothers back in Ireland and he would send them over to marry the other sisters. So the first sister went off and married and had a happy life with her new husband. And the other five sisters were just waiting and watching, looking over the water, waiting and watching for the other five brothers to come over from Ireland, which of course they didn't come. So the father went to the local wise man or the local wizard who said, well, they're not coming. He said, tell your daughters just to stop waiting and watching, because the summer and winter they were there. And the father said, well, we'll not do that. He went back again to the wizard, and the wizard said, well, the only thing to do is to, I'll turn them into mountains, and they can, in the summertime, they can have their summer coats on, you know, their lovely lush greenery looking out, and in the wintertime, they'll be clad with snow for their winter coats. And so therefore, we have the five sisters still waiting there, beautiful sisters, waiting in vain for the five brothers.
Oh.
I know.
So many of these Munros have stories and legends attached to them. Perhaps the most famous one of my favourites, there's two very close to each other, the Shehalion, which I very definitely will climb soon. But there's another one, Ben Lawers, which sits on the north bank of Loch Tay, which is one of Scotland's beautiful lochs. And Ben Lawers is associated with a legend, and that legend is the Lady of Lawers. And the Lady of Lawers is what we would call a seer, S-E-E-R, a prophet, someone who could see into the future. And there's lots of stories about who she was, but it's generally agreed that she was around about the middle of the mid to late 17th century. And she made a number of prophecies, which they claim, like the Bran Seer and like Nostradamus, that they claim that these have come true. Many of them were associated with an ash tree, which was planted when the church was built. And these came true right up until the local farmer cut the ash tree down. And very topical, given that I was in Pamplona last week, he was gored by his own Highland bull. So that one came true. But probably the ones that she's most famous for are her predictions about the Highland clearances, because she said that the sheep would drive the plough from the land. So, of course, the great white sheep coming in the Highland clearances. She said that the crowing of one cock would not be heard by its neighbour, meaning that, you know, the people would be so few and far between on the hillsides round about. So the other one, that the quill of the goose would drive the memory from man. So the printed word rather than the written word written by the quill of a goose. So all of these, you know, have come true, good old Lady of Lawers.
And the other one, which I think is fascinating, she spoke of the fire coaches to be seen passing crossing the Pass of Drumochter, and that was the Highland Main Railway line when it came in mid-1800s. I mean, amazing. I suppose you could turn anything, make it true, find something somewhere that makes it true.
Yep. Well, the Ben Lawers is topical at the moment because a few years ago, my daughter, she takes after her father, not her mother, but she did a quadrathlon called the Glendrocket Challenge. And it is a combination of, you start off with an open water swim across Loch Tay. And when you get to the other side, you then do a ridge run. And this is a ridge of I think it's seven Munros, but there's descents and ascents and whatever. So she did this ridge run. And then when you get to the top, you kayak down the length of the loch, and then you do a cycle round about it. So Kindrochet Challenge. So she completed it. And in actual fact, it's topical because the girls that she completed it, she's flying as we record this. She is flying up today because the girls are meeting. It's a hen weekend for one of them getting married. And so there's a whole series of activities planned, which include climbing mountains, Ben Lawers and Shehalion.
Of course. Yes.
I don't know. Too much energy. Yeah.
Too much energy. But I think Liz, one of the stories, or one of the Munros that's very celebrated, is Loch Nagar. And that's very close to the Balmoral estate. And Prince Charles, when he was Prince Charles, he made up a wee story about the old man of Loch Nagar to entertain his young brothers. And then he wrote it into story form to raise money for the Prince's Trust, which he has done. And the old man of Loch Nagar is a lovely story. It's now in an animated film. And it's Robbie Coltrane who plays the old man, or speaks the voice of the old man. Robbie Coltrane, people will know as Hagrid in the Harry Potter stories. So it's, and the National Ballet have asked or got permission to put on a ballet performance of the old man of Loch Nagar. So it's, but I think one poem by Lord Byron, when he was up in the Highlands, he says, "England, thy beauties are tame and domestic to one who has roved on the mountains afar. Oh, for the crags that are wild and majestic, the steep frowning glories of dark Loch Nagar."
Oh, here Stairs was like us. I know, damn few in the Roddit. We've got a good conceit to ourselves.
That's right. But we could go on forever with stories of the Monroes.
And frequently do. But hopefully we've given people their money's worth. It's run over a wee bit, but hopefully we haven't done one for a while. And of course, we still haven't got on to all the other categories of mountains that we have. We've just been talking about the Monroes. So maybe one for another day to return to, but certainly...
we're stacking those up, these ones, for another day, Liz.
I know. It certainly inspires us to get out there and get some exercise, maybe. So word of the week, Helen.
Well, I was just thinking word of Cooree, C-O-O-R-I-E, because that was the name of the wee hut that I stayed in on Skye, the Cooree Inn. And when you go into a mountain bothy, or you're out in the mountains like you were with your dad, you'd Cooree into each other to keep warm. So Cooree.
Right. Well, as I sit here recording this, I'm looking out over Sallon Golf Course. And if you ever come to the 9-hole golf course at Sallon, the 5th hole is called the Trochel. T-R-A-U-C-H-L-E, the Trochel. And Trochel can either be a verb or a noun, but it's a long, tiring trudge or walk. You know, so when you've got the wind and the hail and the driving rain and you're set on getting to the top of this mountain and it's so slow and you're weary and you're trudging and you're exhausted, that's a fair Trochel.
Oh, that's a good one, Liz. That's a good one. Well, we'll off on our trochling ways now. And, you're off to the north, aren't you, up to Aviemore?
Yeah, I am later today, yes, because as I say, we're meeting up with my daughter. She'll be exhausted after our weekend of trochles.
So, well, thank you again, Liz.
Thank you, Helen. If I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the window.
Exactly. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the moo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.